Have you considered how your company's digital transformation plans might also increase its cyber risk? If not, you might want to join the Security Ledger and RSA Security on May 9th at 11 a.m. for Taking On Digital Transformation. In this webinar, I'll talk with RSA portfolio strategist Steve Schlarman about how IT leaders and executives at cutting-edge firms are addressing digital risk management as part of their overall digital transformation strategies. To learn more or register, point your browser to securityledger.com/risk. This is a Security Ledger podcast, and I'm Paul Roberts, Editor-in-Chief at the Security Ledger. In this week's episode number 145, we continue our series on Life After the Password, the Future of Authentication, by speaking to Ian Patterson, the CEO of the behavioral authentication startup Pluralock. But first, Chris Weissopel, also known as Weldpond, is one of the most recognized and recognizable figures and voices in the information security space. As the co-founder of the seminal Boston hacking collective Loft Heavy Industries in the early 1990s, Weissopel was one of the seven members of Loft who testified before the U.S. Senate's Government Affairs Committee in 1998. More than two decades later, as co-founder and chief technology officer at Veracode, he's a successful technology entrepreneur and one of the clearest voices calling for better design and more secure coding as a solution for endemic online security problems like hacking and data theft. In this interview recorded on the floor of the RSA conference in San Francisco last March, I had the opportunity to talk to Chris about his early days of Loft and the birth of the information security industry, about discovering the first Stack Overflow in the Internet Explorer web browser, and the modern challenges of securing software supply chains. To start out, I asked Chris to talk about his memories of starting Loft back in Boston in the early 1990s.
I'm Paul Roberts. I'm the editor-in-chief of the Security Ledger. Very happy to welcome Chris Weissopel, CTO of Veracode.
Happy to be here. Thanks for being here, Paul.
It's great. And it's great having you right after Katie, because you guys, your history goes back two decades to Boston,
right,
where you grew up and Katie grew up and I grew up. And Loft Heavy Industries, which you really were a founding member of, and grew into for-profit company, which was At Stake.
That's right.
Through various twists and turns, acquisition by Symantec, and then so on, became Veracode.
Exactly.
Talk a little bit about, you know, the early days and how you came to stand up this Loft Heavy Industries community group, really. How you got the idea to kind of commercialize that.
Yeah, so I think the roots of me learning about entrepreneurship actually happened at the Loft, because we were an independent organization. We were in charge of ourselves. We had to learn how to manage ourselves and how to do a budget and how to grow and things like that. So, you know, the Loft was more than just a collection of people, you know, at home on their computers like you might think of a traditional hacker group. We had a physical space. We had equipment. We built a lab for hardware hacking, for software hacking. So to some extent, it was a nonprofit company, or a very low profit company, I would say. Or maybe it ran negative. I think it ran negative. But anyway, it was kind of organized. At one point in the Loft's history, sort of, Loft was kind of around from 92 to about 2000. And somewhere along the way, about halfway through, it became sort of less aimless. Let's just hack the stuff and let's have fun and let's learn and let's make some cool tools. It sort of became a community advocacy group, or a consumer advocacy group, I should say, where we started to think about, we have the capability of understanding the risk that is in software. No one's really doing that, right? Like, there are people who are risk managing enterprises or government organization or a financial institution, and software was a tiny point of that. But we could focus on the software and say, we can tell you if you buy that software, you're taking on a lot of risk. Like, the people producing that software don't know what they're doing as far as security is concerned. We're easily finding vulnerabilities in that. And we thought with this power, we had a responsibility to share our knowledge and share to the world that software is inherently insecure unless you're trying to make it secure. And sort of that put me on sort of this trajectory of, I think, where we land now at Veracode, you know, more than 20 years later. to help people understand the risk in the software they're building and the software they're buying. But back in the 90s, it was just raising awareness that software companies in general don't know what they're doing when it comes to security, and they should change and deliver secure products. So that's probably what I'm most proud of the Loft, was helping change that mindset.
Yeah, I mean, these days, even if an organization doesn't have a great handle on application security, they certainly understand that application and software security are important, right?
Right.
But I'm guessing back then, like, people probably just had literally no idea what you were talking to them about, right?
They had literally no idea. Like, when we reported our first buffer overflow to Microsoft, so the Loft found the very first buffer overflow in Internet Explorer. I think it was like Internet Explorer 4. That's just because 1, 2, and 3 all kind of blurred together in a year or two.
Right.
And so 4 was like one that actually lasted and was out there for a while. And we reported it to them, and they just had no idea what we were talking about. We're like, yeah, but we can show you if you pass this string into the URL field, it will crash the browser. That's bad. They're like, yep, it's a crash bugs. And we're like, no, because it's a Stack Overflow and you have no anti-exploitation. It didn't exist back then. So we can now execute code on your machine. And you know, they just didn't understand. So we actually had to educate them about the problems in their software at a very fundamental level, even that they didn't even understand what a buffer overflow. Like, software engineers know not to overrun a buffer, but they think it's a quality issue. They think the software is just going to give the wrong answer or it's going to crash.
Right.
And we had to educate them, like, no, someone's going to be able to compromise the entire machine by tricking someone to click on a URL. That was a big education moment for them.
How did you learn that yourself? Like, how did you kind of come to understand things like the fact that if you overflow a buffer in the right way, you can plant and run code on the exploited system?
Yeah, so that was essentially knowledge that was starting to get shared among the hacker community, or what you might call the early security community, through mailing lists like BugTrack, where people would explain how they found a problem and how they were able to exploit the problem. The thing was, it was security people and hackers that were having this discussion, not software vendors. So this knowledge started to grow within the hacker community when people understood how to find these, how to exploit them.
Right.
And what we were trying to do was get the attention of the software vendors to say, hey, you should be learning this too.
Right.
So it was really, the community today is still very open. People giving presentations, you know, we do this at RSA, but of course at DEF CON and Black Hat and places like that. So I just learned from other people in the community.
What's really interesting is that even from the very beginning, you have these two distinct communities, the application development community and the application testing or security community, and they're kind of separate spheres. And I guess that's kind of one of the problems in some ways is, while they maybe have moved closer together, they still are in some ways separate spheres.
Definitely. We're still going through that transition at most companies. And what we think doing security as part of the development lifecycle is really necessary to do security at speed. You can do security outside the software development lifecycle, but it's going to be slower and more expensive. So you might just be doing it that way because you've always done it that way, or you haven't transitioned, you know, process change is hard.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you can do security outside the lifecycle. It's just not fast enough for today's development methodologies and the speed of people building software. It can't keep up.
Right.
And so that's why we're seeing organizations actually be forced to make a change to what's ultimately better. But they're being forced to maintain competitiveness. They have to ship software faster and faster and faster. People are competing on, like, who gets the feature out. I mean, you see the whole thing with Snapchat and Instagram stories. They're basically copying each other's features. If you copy a feature a year after someone puts it out, they've already gotten this great mind share and market share. If you copy that feature weeks after they put it out, no one even knows that you had it second. So that think of the competitive landscape for that. Now also say you have a requirement to be secure. You want to be secure, but not if it eliminates your competitiveness because you're trying to run a business,
right?
Not make perfect software.
Right.
So this is a place, if you build it into the life cycle, you can have both. You can have security and competitiveness.
So you spoke yesterday here at the conference. There was a session on security entrepreneurship, basically, and giving advice to would-be entrepreneurs about starting a security company. Your story is really interesting because, again, Loft was really a collective. It was kind of a for-profit organization, but not really.
Right.
And then out of that grew AtStake, which was a company. So I guess, what was your message to them, and what does that experience, what perspective is that experience given you on security entrepreneurship?
to be a successful company, you have to have a strong team and you have to have a strong culture. And those are some of the things that we had at the Loft, that we had it at stake. And, you know, I wanted to replicate at Veracode. One of the great benefits we got at Veracode was we started with six people from At Stake, came across and started the team. So yes, it's almost like we brought some of the culture.
Yes.
That, so if you have good culture, you have to work hard to keep it and maintain it and respect it. And so I think the hacker culture actually is a good culture for companies to have. Right, it's egalitarian, it's a culture of competence, it's a culture of sharing and being open with information, it's a culture of working together. You know, people will just self-form groups to solve problems. Hackers are great problem solvers. These are all things that make a great culture within a technology company, but you know, it needs to span behind the technical people too. That culture has to pervade sales and marketing and IT and services teams. Because the most important thing is that those different teams work together and you don't have these silos and people empire building,
right,
and things like that. So that's sort of the building the positive of a strong company, a strong culture. The other part is eliminating the negative, right? So the number one reason people leave their job is they don't like working for their manager, right? So if you have bad managers, you either have to make them good managers or get rid of them, because it's a multiplier of negativity.
Yes.
Helping people, because if you're in a growing company, you're going to get a lot of first-time managers too, because you're going to get these great employees and their career path, they want to become a manager. So unless you give them that opportunity, they're going to leave the company and go somewhere else. But they're still a first-time manager, so you have to support them with training.
Right.
But the other thing to eliminate is people who are just basically negative actors within the company.
Right.
You know, no matter how competent they are, and some of them are going to be your total rock stars, but they won't work with anyone else.
Right.
Right. And, you know, it takes teams to be successful. Maybe early on, someone who's an individual contributor who's a bad actor who doesn't have to work with anyone, you can handle them for early on. But as soon as your company starts to scale, you have to either tell these people that these are the values of the company, this is our way of doing things, you either need to start doing it this way,
yeah,
or you're going to have to go find somewhere else. So it's both cultivate the good and eliminate the bad.
My guess is in security, that's actually a particular issue as well, because often the people, some of the qualities that might make you a very good vulnerability researcher or pen tester or hacker might be, you know, the ability to work by yourself and self-motivate, kind of an outsider mindset, you know, not necessarily a team player, but somebody who's actually the opposite of that. So that would seem to be a particular challenge in security companies. On the one hand, you want that skill set. On the other hand, some of the personality traits that come along with that might be really difficult in a large organization.
I think it is a challenge, and we have to not have those kind of people. Like, even the people who are deeply technical vulnerability research type people have to be able to work on a team, to be able to follow a process. They have to be able to work with, you know, people, other people within the company.
You know what's really interesting to me about At Stake and Loft is, if you were to say, oh, start a company with a bunch of friends, like, that's usually the start of a really unhappy story, right? I mean,
yeah.
That story often doesn't end well. Somebody ends up being kind of the Pete Best of this, you know, endeavor. Loft and At Stake, while not everybody necessarily stuck with At Stake and the company, everybody kind of went off. So many of you went off and did really interesting things in your own right.
It was painful. We actually had to lay off a couple of people that came over from the Loft just because it wouldn't fit within the budget of the company. Like, their particular skill sets we didn't necessarily need. And when you are a VC-backed company and you have certain profitability and growth targets, it's very painful. And this is why things you do with friends you necessarily can't do in a business.
Yes.
So that was very painful. So the majority of it was good, but there was a couple situations that were
So start a company with friends, good idea, not a good idea?
I think in general it's a good idea, but it's not going to be 100% a good idea. Like, there are going to be some painful things. But you're going to have that in any business, though. Yeah. I mean, there's going to be, and not everything is a perfect, I mean, at a startup company, come on, there's going to be rocky points along the way.
Right.
So you got to be able to weather and persevere and have grit and just stick to it through different problems that you're going to have.
So I should ask you, it's actually been a really eventful year. You guys obviously were acquired by CA and then spun out of CA by Thoma Bravo and are once again an independent company. So give me Chris Weissopel's perspective on that.
It's very exciting. We're calling it Veracode 2.0. outside. So, and then someone pointed out to me, that's the waterfall version number. Shouldn't it be Varicode 2019? And I said, that's probably true.
It's true.
I think it's great because, you know, while there was benefits to being part of CA, certainly it helped us with some very large customers. We did get some very large customers, and we learned how to work with those large customers. In general, it was constraining. Like, we couldn't do the kind of marketing we wanted to do because your business unit can't do corporate marketing, right? You can't do it. We couldn't put out press releases. We couldn't sort of boast about all the great things we were doing as much. It was much more reserved. The story was about CA, not about the Varicode business unit. And that's why we just put out this press release now, because we sort of had all this pent up 19 months of great stuff we've been doing, you know, adding 750 customers, doubling in the last year the lines of code, the number of apps we scan on a monthly basis, you know, different improvements in our products. And sort of we just put out this press release to boast a little bit about all the cool things we're doing, because we feel like we haven't been able to do that for 19 months. It's an exciting time just to be able to talk more boldly about Varicode and what we're doing.
Yeah. So you're going to be talking today with Sam. You're going to be talking about making security a competitive differentiator. Talk to me about, what do you think are the biggest changes you see kind of in the year ahead in terms of making a meaningful improvement in the security posture of, you know, companies who are here looking to buy technology, looking to invest?
Yeah. So I think that part of it is, especially in our space, is it's easy to do, you know, secure one application or secure one server, or it's hard to do it pervasively. Like, one of the big security challenges is scale. And I think that one of the transitioning in security is making a lot of the things we do work at scale. So instead of, like, I'm securing my top five applications, it's like, I'm doing something for all of my applications. Like, a lot of companies is like, well, our executives' mobile phones are secure. Well, what about everyone else? Or our executives' email is secure. Well, what about everyone else? So a lot of the problems that I see is just a basically maturation. Maybe this goes into the RSA conference logo better, which I'm not quite sure what that means. But from my point of view, it's, we know how to do all the things, right? Let's do them at scale. Let's make them easy to do. Let's make them cheaper. Let's make the default.
Sure.
And I think that, to me, is kind of what the better means.
Right.
Not necessarily like, what's the coolest new thing that's a little bit more accurate at something.
Right.
It's actually getting it adopted quicker and working better.
Right. So two big trends, obviously. One is, you know, securing cloud and hybrid environments, right? So many companies today are just dealing with traditional infrastructure. The other, of course, is the proliferation of connected software running things and devices. So the IoT.
Right.
Both would seem to be interesting developments for Varicode and very promising ones, but what is Varicode's attitude vis-a-vis those two things? First of all, working with customers who are moving applications to the cloud, you know, managing applications across both cloud and hybrid environments, and all these different companies, whether they're toy makers, automakers, who are suddenly in the software publishing business.
Right. So just sort of lifting and shifting your enterprise monolith application to the cloud doesn't really change pretty much anything. We're still doing exactly the same thing. But what's happening is, when people are architecting sort of the next generation cloud applications, they're using, you know, lots of microservices, lots of API services, whether they're from their cloud provider or from third parties that are also running in the cloud. Or it's, you know, like you're saying, it's a hybrid. It's maybe between their data center and the cloud, or maybe it's between a mobile device and the cloud. Maybe it's cloud to cloud. And so the big change I see is just the way that the solutions people are developing are becoming more and more distributed. More and more distributed in the code that they're writing, and more distributed in the code that's getting consumed. So, you know, you talk about APIs, you talk about open source, and behind each piece of open source you're consuming, it's probably dependent on other open source. And behind every API you're consuming, it's dependent on other open source and maybe even other APIs. You know, the supply chain is getting very, very complicated, you know, and long, and maybe not understandable unless you have, you know, an automated way to do this. But one of the problems I see is, you know, as soon as you get to that API demarcation point where you don't know what's happening on the other side, you sort of have like unknown risk, right? Unless that API vendor is transparent to you. So essentially, you know, we're seeing the growth. We need the growth of more scalable ways exposing that transparency. Right now, it's a very manual process. It's like, okay, before I sign the contract, you need to fill out this form. And you need to show me you're doing all these things, because unless you're doing that, I'm not going to stuff my log files into your cloud-based log service. Even though financially it makes sense, I have sensitive data in my log files, so I have a requirement of doing that. This transfer of information is very slow. Right, it's not like we can do with open source components, which is we can totally automate the whole thing.
Right,
like we can crawl OpenSace repos, we can look at the NVD, we can inspect that code. There's a lot of transparency that we can gather because it's just code. And the problem is with someone's providing you an API, it's opaque, and we got to fall back to that old supply chain process
right.
that we did when right. we were outsourcing our payroll
right.
to a payroll company. It's but like, oh, you have my employees. Sensitive data, so I have this compliance checklist that we have to go through. We're doing the same thing with something which is a totally technical situation. So I see, you know, some of the movements around what the Department of Commerce is doing around a software bill of materials, that people that are delivering software should be saying what makes up that piece of software. I think that needs to be a living, dynamic thing.
I don't think this commerce thing does necessarily.
No, it doesn't. But, you know, I think we're fast moving to a world where an application is just going to be quickly assembled with a little bit of a glue and dozens of APIs and dozens of open source components. And we can't ignore the security behind all of those APIs. So I don't have the perfect solution, but I think that these need to be living, dynamic, basically published specifications that go alongside the API that say things like, I was assessed by this third party. I use these components. I use these versions of the components.
Right.
These different security processes were run on the code running behind this API.
Right.
And then that's got to go nested to the next level and the next level and all
right.
sort of pushed all the way down.
Because we know those checklists don't work, right?
I don't think the checklist. I mean, we do it because there's nothing else you can do.
Right.
But I think things are starting to move too fast, and that's going to be a real hindrance.
Not scalable.
Yeah.
Chris Weisopel of Veracode, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us on Veracode Live.
Happy to chat with you, Paul. Thanks for being here, too.
Chris Weisopel is the co-founder and chief technology officer at Veracode. We were speaking on the floor of the recent RSA conference in San Francisco. Up next, when the virtualization software firm Citrix said in March that it was the victim of a months-long cyber espionage campaign, law enforcement attention focused on a so-called password spraying attack as the likely culprit. The low-tech hack simply requires cybercriminals to attempt to remotely access Citrix accounts using known usernames in combination with weak passwords. Password spraying and brute force attacks like that are common, and they're just one more proof point that single-factor authentication, though vulnerable, remains incredibly common. In our second segment, we sat down with someone who wants to change all that. Ian Patterson is the CEO of the firm Pluralock, which is one of a slew of next-generation behavioral authentication firms to crop up in recent years. He says that the writing is already on the wall for traditional passwords, as tools like password managers are fast turning alphanumeric passwords from something you know and can remember to something you have.
Ian Patterson, Chief Executive Officer at Pluralock Cybersecurity Solutions, Inc. So we're an early stage cybersecurity company. We use human behavior as a form of authentication for business users. So think about how you typically act throughout the day, how you walk, how you talk, how you sit, how you type. We use that as a form of behavioral biometrics as part of our risk-based authentication capabilities for customers like banks, power plants, militaries, government agencies, really organizations that need stronger levels of security.
For most of us, username passwords, probably the most common form of identity or authentication we're using to access services. And then maybe folks are using second factors. So, one-time password, some kind of digital token, hard token. What is Pluralock's technology about?
So what we're realizing is that business users in particular are trying to grapple with this dichotomy of passwords being ubiquitous, not terribly secure, known to be broken. And on the other end of the spectrum, you have really strong crypto with tokens or YubiKeys or six-digit rotating numbers. And there's not really a lot of middle ground. And I think the challenge that CISOs have in particular is the recognition that they need two-factor or multi-factor authentication within their business, but resistance from their employee base to constantly carry around hardware or having to fish around for their phone in order to gain access to business applications. So what we do is we use literally the way that you type on a keyboard and the way that you move a mouse as a form of behavioral biometrics. So it forms a digital fingerprint for who you are as a person. And then depending on the risk level, when we see you authenticate, then we may still ask you for an additional hardware device. But 99% of the time, we just want to let you in a way that's much more easy to get through your day and really focus on the things that you're trying to do as a business.
Keystrokes, mouse movements, what other types of things can you guys capture?
So we're looking at behavior and we're also looking at context. So the behavior is exactly what you just mentioned, keystrokes, mouse movements. What is your pattern of life? Are you typically connecting at 9 in the morning? Or if you show up at 2 a.m., is that outside the realm of what your standard behavior looks like? We also look at things like geo-velocity. So traditional geo-fencing rules can be fairly cumbersome, where you draw a bounding box around your office and say, look, this is a known good location, and we'll let you in if you're within this box. What we do is we actually look at travel times. So from the last time that you've logged in to the present time that you're trying to log in right now, we'll actually compute the travel time between those two locations. And if it's physically possible to travel, then that's okay. If you were, for instance, connecting from Tokyo and then 2 minutes later tried to connect in from Seattle, well, we know that that's physically impossible. We don't need to create any geofencing rules. We just know that you can't travel in that amount of time and that amount of distance. So those are the types of risk factors that we're looking at. We look at between 20 and 40 different signals, depending on what device you're connecting from and what are the policies configured for that organization. And then we combine those into a single risk score. So we get a 0 to 1 rating, effectively, on how risky is this person when they're trying to authenticate. And then based on that score, we can either grant them access, we can deny them access, or we can take progressive next steps on somehow getting better clarity on the identity of that individual.
So one of the problems with things like biometrics is that there is obviously a lot of variability. And I know you've demonstrated that, you know, if you have an injured hand, for example, you could log in with one hand, which of course would really throw off the keystroke biometric, but that your technology would often still authenticate that person based on the other factors. But how do you deal with just all that messy space in the biometrics area?
Yeah, I mean, you're pointing out something that is endemic to biometrics in general. You know, the same thing happens with fingerprint readers, right? So if you have sunscreen on your hands, it's actually very difficult to get your thumbprint read properly. So look, there's pros and cons to everything. For biometrics in particular, you're not looking at a black and white decision. You know, unlike a password, it's either correct or it's not correct. With biometrics, it's always a risk decision. How likely is it that the person that you're trying to identify is in fact the right person? So you have to think about it in that context. But the other benefit of having more of a risk-based approach is you can take different actions depending on how confident that you are that it's the right person. So if I'm trying to log in and I score a 0.8 or a 0.9 when I'm trying to authenticate, I might just get let in right away. But if there's a decent amount of risk in the behavior that I'm exhibiting, rather than just locking you out or letting you in, we can challenge you, we can call you, we can send an alert to the SIM and have a security analyst review it. Like there's different workflows that we can go through that still allows the user to get through. But we can take the appropriate level of additional validation that we need to. That's really the big mind shift. And it's most useful in situations where you have a lot of volume, where you're seeing the same person very often, and you need something stronger than just login and password. But for business reasons or for cost reasons, as a security team, you can't just prescribe to use hardware all the time on every single interaction. So you're left with this middle ground of how do we provide better security without encumbering the users from getting their job done at the end of the day? And biometrics is actually a fairly good fit for that. Much in the same way that biometrics on phones have become more of an accepted solution. You know, they're not perfect. I certainly can't always get my phone to recognize my thumbprint, but it's good enough. And if I need to, then I can fall back to that PIN number. It's the same. It's really the same model for what we do.
You know, it strikes me that you have sophisticated firms that are really looking kind of beyond username and password. But obviously, for the vast majority of companies out there, not much has changed in terms of how their employees are accessing their network and applications and data. It's still username and password. What is Plurilock seeing, both who are your customers and what is driving interest amongst companies in moving beyond username and password? And I guess, are they looking to move beyond it or merely supplement it?
It's really interesting. So our customers today, a lot in financial services, some critical infrastructure, some government as well. And then we also have some non-regulated industries, industrial manufacturing that we service. I'd say that the trend that we're seeing is that everybody recognizes that login and passwords are terrible. The difference comes with some people are looking to go completely beyond that and go to a passwordless solution. I would say that the majority that we're working with today are just looking to augment login and password. Either they feel that they can't move beyond it for technical reasons, or they may feel that for regulatory reasons, they have to include login and passwords as part of their identity suite. And so the question then becomes, you know, how do we better secure this thing that we have to have? We joke internally. We had a terrific conversation with the chief information security officer for a very large financial institution, and his words were, he considers passwords to be nuclear waste. It's this necessary evil that's just so rife with risk and exposure that the day that you can move beyond them is the day that you can actually breathe a sigh of relief. And I think a lot of people share that sentiment. So, you know, do what you can to augment them. You know, we always recommend to subscribe to threat intel feeds to be able to monitor at least if passwords are being breached elsewhere for your employees. Deploy two-factor, multi-factor authentication in as many places as possible. Basically, anywhere that supports it, you should use it, and you should actually start making buying decisions on the basis of, can you use 2FA or MFA with that solution that you're looking to procure? And I think that you can evolve to a much better steady state when it comes to security. The best in class companies that we're seeing and that we're working with already have some sort of hardware based token in use. And rather than it being an either or of, do I use the hardware token or do I not use the hardware token? They're actually saying, look, everywhere we want to authenticate users, we want to have some sort of risk-based piece in front of it. And then for the areas that we really need absolute certainty, then use something like a FIDO2 approved device where you actually can have certainty through a hardware means. But be realistic about when you can demand that of users and what are the trade-offs that you need to make in order to balance that usability as well as security.
Really interesting. You mentioned companies not being able to get rid of passwords because of concerns about, you know, let's say compliance. It strikes me that one big obstacle as we look to move beyond usernames and passwords may be just the sheer number of different regulations, whether it's, PCI or HIPAA or Sarbanes-Oxley that make some reference to strong passwords and password-based technologies. And regardless of the fact that there might be a more secure alternative, you know, the wording is what it is. Do we end up in a situation where companies are holding on to these technologies simply because they have to?
I think that you're absolutely right, which is unfortunate, but it's the world that we live in. One thing that we have had really good success with is being able to make passwords easier to use. So to give you an example, generally speaking, when you're dealing with regulations, there's going to be requirements around password rotation and password complexity rules. And what we've been able to do with our customers and the auditors who are going through and certifying our customers' compliance with regulations is by using a solution like Plurilock, which is a risk-based approach to authentication. You can refer to Plurilock as being a compensating IT control that gives you a pass on having to change your password every 30 days or use complexity rules in the creation of new passwords. There's already been some movement by the industry. I think GCHQ a couple years ago was the first one to really publicize it, that password rotation wasn't actually a best practice. Microsoft just recently came out as well in the last couple of weeks and put forth some moves towards not making password rotation mandatory in all places.
Yeah, saying they weren't going to require their employees to do that, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so we actually get a lot of benefit from just saying, look, don't make your employees change every 30 days and don't make them long and complex. And that alone reduces a lot of the friction from passwords already. You know, to your point, I think a lot of organizations feel like they're stuck, whether they are or they aren't is more of a decision for them. But certainly for the ones who do feel like they're stuck, there are things that you can do with newer technology like Plurilock just to make the whole experience easier for users, which ultimately increases security for your organization.
And I think in our minds, we all have this notion of eventually getting to this place where you just sort of authenticate based on who you are and your movements and some combination of date, you know, kind of observable data and biometrics. But as you look at it, how much longer do you expect the traditional alphanumeric password to be with us? And when it finally does go the way of the dodo, what's gonna push it over the edge?
I think that there are some really innovative companies that are out there that have already moved to a passwordless solution and are setting that trend for what life looks like beyond the password. I think that you also have a tremendous amount of legacy systems that are still not even connected to Active Directory. And it's going to take quite a long time before we can decommission those or move them to a state where you no longer need passwords. And certainly password managers are moving in the same direction. Passwords are no longer actually something that you know. Passwords are becoming something that you have, right? By using a password manager, you're actually saying, I don't actually know this password, but I have this effectively secure token that allows me access into a site or into a resource or into an application.
Right.
And so I think what we are seeing is that passwords themselves we're getting better at having a unique password per site, which ends up becoming just a token that you store somewhere. And I think that trend will continue. I think that the amount of things that a person mm-hmm. needs to actually remember, like a PIN number or a password, will continue to decrease. I definitely see where, as a user, you might have two or three effectively master passwords that are going to lock your password vault or your password manager, and then you'll be able to use that for everything else. I think that's kind of the stepping stone of where we're going to before we actually get to that nirvana that you're describing, which is, hey, we don't actually need to do this anymore.
Well, happy belated password day to you, Ian, and thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us on the Security Ledger podcast.
Likewise, thanks for having me.
Ian Patterson is the CEO of the firm Plurilock. He came into the studio to talk with me about the future of authentication as part of our series, Life After Passwords.